Now we're going to wash you pretty soon and put you in the tub. I said, yeah, man, goddamn. And he said, and we're going to wash you. This is a sponge, and I am going to wash your back, he said. Okay, I said, and it's going to hurt. Ain't going to hurt me, man, I said. One day I said, motherfucker, put me in the tub. I don't want to hear this shit anymore. Just wash my ass, please. So they put me in this tub, and he said, how do you feel? After some preparation, he ran it across my back, and I swear to God I screamed like a baby. Can't even describe that pain. Shit, fuck, motherfucker, oh, goddamn shit, oh, fuck, God, help me, fuck, 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 fuck. Doesn't even come close. Don't touch another motherfucking thing on me. I'm getting out and walking out. I don't care if I die, but you ain't gonna touch me with that motherfucking sponge. Please don't touch me with that stuff. After receiving this treatment twice a day for 4 weeks, a nurse mentioned that they weren't authorized to give me painkillers. But if I asked for them, I've been here all this time, and you're just now telling me that all I have to do is ask, I said incredulously. Yes, Mr. Pryor. I went right back to my room, buzzed my doctor, and told him that I wanted painkillers. I watched as the nurse injected Demerol in my IV. Moments later, the most throbbing pain I'd ever felt melted into thin air. It was like a pleasant little hum overtook my entire being, brain, and body, and I understood the nod of heroin addicts. They go for that hum. Between the scrubbing and the skin grafts that initiated the long, painful healing process, I had no doubt of the horror story I created. Toward the end of my hospital stay, I also began talking with a therapist who tried addressing the problems and feelings that led to my suicide attempt. This psychiatrist got right to business, made me talk about my ma, my grandmother, my father, the neighborhood where I grew up. I cried like a baby. I wasn't even being scrubbed. The toxicity level of my blood was so high from the amount of drugs I'd done prior to the accident that doctors erroneously thought I must have been sneaking coke into the hospital. They questioned me daily. During that time, though, the only drug I had, other than what was prescribed by doctors, was television. Every Sunday I watched the religious shows. Those televangelists became my new addiction. They were so obviously full of shit, hustling the poor in the name of God, that I started imagining what would happen if Jesus himself surprised one of those charlatans by walking into the picture and tapping him on the shoulder, you know? Well, hi, Jesus, I was just talking about what you said and... Said what? And where? Man, what are you talking about? I can't even write. Don't know how to spell. What are you talking about? Well, you know that you said you was so-and-so. Man, I didn't say none of it. I didn't say any of that stuff in that book. But here I am. Hallelujah. Yeah, thought I'd visit the United States. I hear and see so much. You all say so much about me. Put so many things in my mouth. Make me out to be different, like I give special concessions for special people and so forth. But my law is my law. No exceptions. Amen. Don't know what you're so happy about, brother. In any case, as long as I'm here, there are just a few people I'd like to say hello to. Like, I remember there was a guy who had this dream that one day people of all colors ring a bell. Martin Luther King Jr. Yeah, good guy. I'd like to say hello. He was killed. Assassinated. What? I don't believe it. God bless his soul. You leave my father out of this. Now how about this leader you people used to have? Man said something about not what the country could do for you, but what you could do for... I'd just like to have a quick word with him. He was also assassinated. I don't believe you people. I also know of some children, little children, who said their prayers every night. I loved hearing them pray. Such good kids. Little voices sounded like music. I'd just like to say goodbye to them. I'm sorry. Them too? Just because they were different colors? I'm afraid so. I'll give you something to be afraid of, Jack. I mean, how can you mess up so badly? How can you just destroy love? My father gave you this world, and I gave you love. If you mess that up too, I hope somebody will have mercy on you, because I certainly won't. Thank you, Jesus. Now, people, how can you resist a heartfelt plea like that? Please send in whatever you can. $10, $20, $50, we have payment plans. Going home was a relief. Buoyed by 25,000 letters from well-wishers and an army of visitors, I settled into the slow, painstaking, and painful routine of recovery. Basically, that consisted of taking baths and rubbing salves into my skin. At night, I slept in a corset that was supposed to prevent my grafts from shrinking. I was also supposed to try not to scratch, but my fingernails scraped the soft, itchy skin until I drew blood. In my state, pleasure and pain were the same. I was fortunate to have survived my fiery accident, but after the doctors, treatments, and pills were all done, I was still afflicted with the same old problems, fears, and pains that had caused me to drink a bottle of vodka a day, spend upward of $250,000 a year on cocaine, beat women, and then work to make them love me again. The scars I now had on the outside only mirrored the ones I'd had on the inside my entire life. Naturally, I got hung up on the superficial. I didn't think I could ever let a woman see me again, you know? That was something basic, something immediate. For a while there, I flashed on the great pussy drought of the 1980s, and, brother, it was a frightening thought. If I couldn't fuck no more, then what, you know? I was wrong, though. Deborah, bless her heart, was my first woman after the accident. After the fire, a lot of people said, God was punishing you. No, if God wanted to punish my ass, he would have burned my dick. When the fire hit, my dick went to work. Emergency, piss, come, do something. Don't let the fire get to the balls. And my chest was hollering, help. My dick said, fuck you. Every man for himself. Spit. I'm protecting the balls. Deborah, it was like I'd never done it before. But then, oh God, did I do it, you know. It was beautiful. I felt myself fall in love. With Deborah. Always with Deborah. But also with life. I saw it all. The brightness that starts the day, makes the flowers, causes a hobo to smile, and inspires a woman to sing. It was right there, man. Life. As bright as the fucking sun. I rubbed it all over my damn face. And for that moment, it was mine. I was glad to be alive. 28. I'd never been higher than I was in Hawaii one day toward the end of 1980. After 10 hours worth of flying lessons, I took over the controls of my single-engine Grumman Tiger and piloted the plane myself from Oahu to Maui. It was a transcendental moment. My whole life I'd wanted to fly. As a kid, I'd told one of my teachers about my dream, and he laughed at me. I could still hear him say, Richard, you can't do that. Yet at age 40, I was doing just that. Likewise, plenty of people doubted whether I'd be able to refrain from my self-destructive ways. Privately, I was among them. But as I soared above the lush, emerald green island, banking to the right, then to the left, and then slowly circling the island's crystal blue perimeter. I was overwhelmed by the freedom of being above it all. I felt as if I could prove them wrong, too. Any doubts I had about how the public would react following the accident were quickly erased. After its December release, Stir Crazy went on a tear at the box office, grossing more than $100 million. In April, the Hollywood community showed their support with a standing ovation when I presented an Oscar at the Academy Awards. Then Bustin' Loose, which I finished after recovering from my burns, continued my winning streak that summer. In Hawaii, the high life was replaced by a healthy, isolated life in Hana. I retreated into the slow lane of my newly completed modern Japanese-style home, which was situated on a hill overlooking 5 plush, gorgeously landscaped acres of flowers and trees. Every room had its own deck. I looked outside into the gardens and then out beyond to the ocean, and one word came to mind. Yes. But fruit juices, jogging, and shoji doors didn't ensure life would be as sweet as the orchids in my garden. The affection I craved was still damn elusive. I tried Deborah. I dallied with a Korean actress. I coerced my cute Japanese maid in Hawaii. I pretty pleased Jennifer back into my life. I tried all 31 flavors, whatever I felt like at the time. But when it came to women's relationships, trying to satisfy the urge to get loved, I couldn't find the right prescription. It's not that I lacked for love, but what I was able to feel was as momentary as the high I got sucking on the pipe. My therapist plumbed my childhood for reasons. Motherfucker made some points that were hard to accept, but true. That's why life stinks, I said. What do you mean? To me, this life stinks because all we want is love, I went on. That's all anybody wants. Black, white, orange, race, nationality, none of that shit matters. We're all human beings and we all want love. That's all. I think you're right, he said. How does that make life stink? Because the motherfucker's fleeting, you know? It won't stay put. Was that the problem, Rich? Or was it that you didn't love yourself? In February 1981, I returned to the mainland to prepare for work on Some Kind of Hero. Drug-free until then, my Northridge house was filled with the ghosts of when I wasn't clean. They'd waited around like ghoulish fans for my homecoming, but instead of wanting my autograph, they asked, "When we gonna smoke, Rich? When we gonna get high, man?" The big house had been vacuumed and cleaned of all my old drug paraphernalia 8 months earlier. The day of my accident, the stuff had been thrown out. Not on account of me. No, nobody wanted the police to find it. But as soon as I walked inside that place, I knew there was some shit around. I sensed it. Sniffed it like a bloodhound. After waiting till the house was quiet and I was alone, I went to where I kept my super-secret stash, a little drawer. Lo and behold, I had the exhilarating rush of a prospector who pans the river, sifts through the silt, looks down, and sees a golden nugget sparkling in the sunlight. Eureka! There was a little rock. One perfect little rock. I picked it up and marveled at its whiteness, brightness. A star in the night sky. Make a wish, Rich. A few minutes later, I found a glass pipe. Locked in the bedroom, I flicked my Bic for the first time since the fire. Oh, Jesus, I sighed as the rush began. Oh, God. Though I appeared to be fine in form, as some kind of hero film that summer, I'd climbed aboard the old self-destructive roller coaster without anybody knowing it. I wanted so badly to prove that I was the same old Richard Pryor that I actually became him. I kept a tiny pipe in my trailer and got loaded whenever I could get my hands on some coke. By August, I was back in the same rut. So was my personal life. My six-month affair with Hero co-star Margot Kidder ended just before the movie did, when she discovered that I was cheating on her. She didn't get mad much. She got even by coming over to the hotel where I'd taken up permanent residence and scissoring the Armani wardrobe hanging in my closet. Thank God that's all she cut. In the meantime, I repaired old ties. Before Hero ended, I'd proposed to Jennifer. It took 3 tries, including a final proposal at a pool party in Hana, where I smoked some Maui Waui pot that was as powerful as an LSD trip, before she finally accepted. Our marriage took place in a backyard ceremony on August 16, 1981, and Jenny looked resplendent in white and flowers, but the event was short on celebration. As for a reception, Margot sent an angry telegram. My pretty Japanese maid, who'd taken to keeping a bottle of vodka by the Mr. Clean, using one to mop and the other to mope, got sloppy drunk and cried that she was losing me. And in the morning, having sobered up, I called my attorney in L.A. and asked him to get the damn marriage annulled. I woke up and realized what I'd done, I explained. I said, "Shit, I don't want to be married." By October, I had initiated preliminary divorce proceedings, slept with other women, and physically pummeled Jennifer. But something in me couldn't let go completely. Pressured into making another concert film, which I wasn't ready to do, I knew instinctively that I had to hang on to Jenny in some way, shape, or form. She'd gone through it with me before. "You aren't ready," she counseled. "Don't do it." "They're telling me that I have to cash in," I countered. "They say now's my time, now's my time." But December came and I knew it wasn't time. Rather than work out for weeks and then tour, honing each routine to a razor sharpness, as I did before the first concert picture in 1979, I went up to Oakland the week before we filmed and fucked up. Too much booze, too much coke. I was little better when I got in front of the camera the first night at the Hollywood Palladium. In a scene reminiscent of my breakdown in Las Vegas 15 years earlier, I asked myself, "What the fuck am I doing here?" Then I walked off stage. Over the next couple days, I delivered the goods, enough so that producer Ray Stark, agent Guy McElwain, and other powers behind the movie were mostly satisfied, but all of them knew they'd need to reshoot parts. As for me, I split for Hawaii. Told Jennifer, "They made the gentle mistake of giving me the money in advance. Bye-bye." "They didn't give you all the money," she said. "Yes, they did," I said, flashing an evil smile. Eventually, I finished the live concert film by performing at what was essentially an invitation-only party. But after the footage was spliced with the Palladium bits, it still played as inspired, cutting-edge theater. Even so, live on the Sunset Strip wasn't as great an overall performance as the first concert picture. But with routines like Mafia Club, Africa, and Free Bass, it had its moments. And fortunately, so did I. It's nice to be able to laugh later. I thank you all for the love you sent me. And I mean that sincerely. Offstage, I was not nearly as sentimental. In January 1982, I embarked on Jennifer's and my belated honeymoon, a cruise through the Caribbean. If we hadn't been fighting at the time of departure, she would also have been on board the Silver Trident, the luxury yacht I'd leased for the occasion. In her place, I found other female amusement when I wasn't too fucked up. But I missed her terribly, and after 10 days of ship to shore, me sweet-talking and pleading from such appropriately romantic-sounding locales as Teardrop Cove, she succumbed to the lure of our mad addiction to each other. It may not have been a traditional honeymoon, but there was no mistaking it as anything but ours. Wild and woolly, we were George and Martha sailing across the high seas of love. Passionate lovemaking spoiled by drinking and fighting. After less than 2 weeks, she jumped ship and got a divorce lawyer, and I finished up the vacation with another woman. As always, Dr. Jekyll's good intentions were fucked up by Mr. Hyde. The shit was beyond my control. I couldn't escape the darkness. Late on the night of March 4, 1982, John Belushi, Robin Williams, and Robert De Niro had come by the Comedy Store looking for me to participate in their wee hours carousing. Luckily, I happened not to be there. Otherwise, I might have, and to my mind, probably would have, ended up going back to the Chateau Marmont and doing cocaine with Belushi, who died early on March 5th. It could have easily been me. I was just as lucky in cheating death a month and a half later when I worked on The Toy with Jackie Gleason in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I didn't much care for the picture. Like the others, I did it for the monies. But Jackie and I hit it off famously, like kindred souls. The shit Jackie talked between setups was funnier than anything we got in the movie. He knew about gangsters, gamblers, comics, vaudeville, strippers, and sharks. He started talking about something that happened in the 1970s, and then suddenly he'd be swirling around the 1920s and 30s, describing people and joints so good I could smell them. One day he asked me to get him some grass. I found some and gave it to him on the bench where we used to sit and talk. It overlooked a lake that had no fish in it, but Jackie didn't like the way I handed it to him. He showed me a sneaky way of handling the exchange, and then he winked. "That's called a switch," he said. We laughed. 2 stars, getting paid a few million dollars, and we were practicing dope deals. God damn, that was funny to me. Then things got serious. One day I felt my heart pound in rebellion to my secret dalliances with the evil white lady. An ambulance rushed me to a New Orleans hospital. I really thought I might actually die right then, and the only thing that really bothered me about it was being in the South. Down there, people didn't care if a black man died, or else the Klan would be so glad they'd declare a holiday. Otherwise, I figured the rest of my family had gone. Maybe it was my time, you know? But it turned out to be a warning. According to the doctors, it was my Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome acting up, a sudden arrhythmia, which they could treat. I explained that the palpitations had come during a scene I shot in a swamp opposite a live alligator. The gator had said, "Ah, blackened catfish." With that, my heart began sprinting for shore. It didn't know the rest of me couldn't swim. Deep down, I knew the truth. Lying in my hospital bed, I let my mind wander back to the time when I'd asked Red Fox why I always wanted more cocaine, and how he'd looked at my ignorant face and told me it was because I was an addict. An addict. I didn't tell anyone, as if it was a secret, as if it wasn't true. But who are you fooling, Rich? Even then you wanted more. 29. Yes, I was unrepentant, even with that scare, as I went off to London to play the villain in Superman 3. And yes, the movie was a piece of shit. But even before I read the script, the producers offered me $4 million, more than any black actor had ever been paid. "For a piece of shit," I told my agent when I finally read the script. "It smells great." But the money couldn't buy what I needed. One night, Margot Kidder stopped by my room to see if I'd go out with her. She observed me sitting in the middle of the floor of a vast, luxurious suite, sucking on a crack pipe. I was surrounded by empty vials. She muttered something about me being such a sad sight. So fucking sad. What could I say? "What did you say, Rich?" Nothing. I just kept smoking. There were moments when I dreamed of escaping my misery just as I had before I'd set myself on fire. I just couldn't find an escape that suited me. I took my kids to Hana for Christmas, making a big show of it, though in truth it was nothing more than an empty gesture. I wasn't capable of anything else. Remember when Rain stood in the doorway? She and the others were going to the beach. Daddy, come with us, she said. Come on. I was grouchy and hungover. I looked out at the beautiful Hawaiian afternoon, sunny and warm. The blue Pacific glistened in the distance like a sapphire I might have given a woman after having the guilties for cheating on her. None of it registered with me. I wanted the kids to go already. But they wanted their dad. So? That's what I thought. I just wanted to do my base. Then the strangest thing happened. Left alone, I asked myself what I was doing. You know, in a moment of clarity, I glimpsed the absolute pitifulness of my situation. Got a clear view through the window of hopelessness and despair. You go through changes in your life and you just fucking change. Something happened in my life just fucking changed my mind about all the shit. I used to think I knew everything, man. I'd be fucked up and I knew it. I knew all the shit. And all of a sudden, I didn't know shit. I was one of the dumbest motherfuckers that ever lived. If you catch me on the wrong day and ask me my name, you're gonna get trouble. How'd you end up like that again, Rich? Although the answer was in my heart, I dealt with what was in my hands. Trembling but determined, I tossed the shit in the garbage. For real. No hiding the pipe in one drawer and the rock in another and tiptoeing away for a few minutes. I chucked it. Grabbing my cigarettes, I walked to the beach. As I shuffled onto the sand, my kids looked as if they saw an alien. In a way, they did. Daddy! Even I was tempted to turn around and look at who they were talking about. Daddy! But then it was great. Rain taught me how to float. Bobbing in the salty water, I got into the sensation of buoyancy, the feeling of levitating off the ground. I imagined drifting away from my addiction, away from the dark rooms where I was prisoner to the pipe. Staring up at the sky, I saw the immensity of the spinning world. The gulls squawked. My kids squawked. The water slapped the shore, like music, and I was in the middle of it, alive, and grateful to be there, you know? Several weeks later, I got a call from a friend. Coincidentally, she'd checked herself into rehab and wanted me to help her in recovery by participating in therapy. Ordinarily, I would have told her no. In my neighborhood, the administration of affection had always been a one-way street. However, in my newfound sobriety, I asked where and when and hopped on a plane. Although there was no bigger skeptic than me, the therapy sessions had an unanticipated effect on me. I listened in the group meetings where people stood up and told harrowing stories caused by their addictions. I thought back to when I was 7 and my grandmother took me to an evangelist in Springfield and pleaded with him to rid me of the devil. Even then I thought that shit was funny. But now I heard things that sounded too familiar to laugh off. Gradually I recognized the picture being assembled by these confessions was of me. I had to quit drinking. I got tired of waking up in my car driving 90, you know? Trying to talk to the police when your mouth don't work. One day, caught in the fervor, I stood up and admitted that I, too, was a drug addict and alcoholic. It wasn't anything I didn't know already. Amen. Or hadn't known for many years. Sing it, brother. But to say it out loud in front of strangers without adding a punchline, man, that was like saying adios to the greatest, funniest character I'd ever created. My best work, you know. And it scared the hell out of me. Hallelujah. I know you, motherfucker, I said. We ran for a long time. But I'm tired of you hurting me. Let's declare a truce. Leave each other alone. See how it goes, you know? No response. Okay? No response. Please? We'll see. If you just shut up. Even sober, I couldn't control my addiction to the women's. Deborah started out by my side when I began a lengthy spring tour in preparation for another live concert film. But after a performance in Washington, D.C., I met 20-year-old Flynn Belaine. Within 2 days, I shuffled Debbie off to Buffalo, so to speak, and cozied up to Flynn. By any standards, Flynn was drop-dead fine. Strong legs, nice breasts, and sweet smile. I was like a mouse sniffing around a trap. But it was good, you know. There were other women's, too. A Julie in New Orleans, where I filmed most of Here and Now. But when I added the finishing touches to the film in New York, I had Flynn meet me there. Then I set her up in L.A. By August, though, I lost interest in her and went back to Jennifer. Naughty me. Couldn't help myself, and neither could she. Flynn, bless her, was tough. She didn't give up. I wanted nothing to do with her, but she had other ideas. One day, Jennifer slipped into my rolls and saw a pair of baby booties hanging from the rearview mirror. Her eyes rolled. Flynn sent them, I said. You know what she's telling you, right? Jenny asked. Indeed. In February 1984, right before I received the Black Filmmakers Hall of Fame Award, Flynn broke the news. She was pregnant. Clearly, I was a productive motherfucker deserving of some Hall of Fame. But instead of celebrating Flynn's announcement, I ran to Deborah seeking consolation, advice, excuses. Seeking something. She knew as well as I did that my own need for parenting far exceeded my ability to be one. My life sentence, you know. But that poor, pitiful me shit didn't play in Peoria, and it sure didn't play on Debbie's doorstep. Well, what am I supposed to do about it? Debbie asked. I didn't get her pregnant. I've got to do the right thing, I said. For some reason, I thought I saw the pieces of my life falling into place much like a puzzle. Events took on a pattern and meaning. Such nonsense began making a certain amount of sense. I don't know why. Following my accident, I had tried to write my autobiography, but never quite got a grip on the 300-pound alligator that was my life. Still too close to the fire. Didn't have perspective. I kept at it, though. Thinking about shit. Writing down bits and pieces, thoughts and shit. Finally, I asked Mooney and Rocco Urbiski, a writer friend, to help me stitch it all together, and the result was JoJo Dancer, Your Life is Calling. Originally, I intended it to be a straight-out comedy, but I couldn't keep the sadness and emotion from spilling onto the page. It was beyond me, you know? Like therapy. I went with it. Maybe a documentary would have played better. It would have had the edge of my stand-up. More dick, less heart. Or maybe more hard and less dick, I don't know. I never will either. JoJo was the latest and biggest project my company, Indigo Productions, produced as part of a $40 million deal with Columbia Pictures. For my money, which it was, Indigo was a fiasco. Something much bigger than I could handle. I didn't know how to run a company, and come to think of it, I didn't even want a company, you know? Jim Brown did, though. I made my friend, Jim, president. At the end of 1983, I fired him, and all hell came down on top of me. Jim, a complex man, liked running that company more than I liked having it. He hired lots of people. He made lots of noise. He commissioned numerous scripts, started up all sorts of projects. However, I wasn't happy about where the company was going. The only thing I cared about was the work, and when I sat down to read the scripts that had been developed, I couldn't find one that stood out as special. Not one screen to be made, you know. I had to ask myself a serious question, something I tried my damnedest to avoid. Rich, do you want the company? No. And that's basically what I decided to tell Jim when I fired him. I caught shit, though. The black film community was outraged. The NAACP turned on me. Everybody, it seemed to me, acted like it was my obligation to employ people just because of their skin color. They didn't understand. I didn't want to employ anybody, black, white, or purple. I didn't give a shit anymore. JoJo was the exception. The project was my own creation, my own madness. Certainly it takes a degree of madness to produce, direct, co-write, and star in a movie. By the time I took all that damn film in the editing bay, I felt like a snake charmer slowly being strangled by his own charming pet viper. I just wanted to know how I might have fucked up. Not that I could see anything wrong. I was too close, and everyone around me only said how brilliant it was. Genius, Rich, that's what it is. All that shit. But goddammit, I knew better. I just wanted someone to tell me where the holes were, you know? Right there, the doctor said. Look there. Glenn's legs were apart. My eyes were riveted to that amazing sight. My son Stephen entering the world. On November 16, 1984, I actually stood in the delivery room and watched him being born. And now I can finally say it. I'm glad I was sober. If you've never seen a baby born, you ain't seen shit. I know if men had to push babies out their asshole, there'd be no question about abortion. Not even a smither of a question. I saw this woman who I loved lying on a table with her legs open, a baby coming out of her pussy, and she had a smile on her face. Right then I knew she was crazy. That was proof. I was just praying to God that the baby didn't come out and grab her hemorrhoids. Then he came out. And that made me realize women have been bullshitting us. You know when you're fucking, really working, doing some serious damage, and she says, "It hurts." Well, if your dick is not as big around as my thigh, you ain't hurting shit, okay? I saw a baby. A whole entire human being come out of this lady's pussy. The doctor let me help pull him out. It was my baby boy, you know. You hold it in your arms and do the stupidest shit. While she was recovering from the pain and the blood and shit, I took that little guy and held him up in the air. Like, behold, the only man greater than myself. Then the doctor says, "Can you give him back to the mother so she can feed him?" "No, motherfucker, I'm not finished beholding yet." I still refused to marry Flynn, and it cost me. I came back from a gambling binge in Las Vegas, had my winnings in a briefcase, some $600,000 I'd won at the blackjack table. Flynn's lawyer was the first to congratulate me. "That's how much she'll need to take care of the boy," he said. That's life sometimes. A simple, unpredictable roll of the dice. Part 3 Mudbone, Part 3
Now, something's obvious to me. These here times we live in are trying times. But you know what? Ain't never been no time when folks didn't have to try. Shit, you gotta try. Every day you gotta try and get your lazy ass out of bed in the morning. You gotta try and get something to eat, something to drink. Fine, get a little pussy now and then. Now, Rich, he had spunk. He had a heart attack and then went on TV and said he could still make love 9 or 10 times a day. Absolutely knew he could. All he had to do was meet a woman, and then he'd prove it. Except it was a cover-up. Boy was suffering. Worn out. I knowed he was tired. Loss of nerve, maybe. Bad breaks, for sure. Not long after his movie came out, people were talking about how he'd changed, looked skinny and sickly. People started talking it was AIDS and shit. Thought never crossed my mind, 'cause I know human nature. Truth is, you lock yourself in a dark room and breathe that devil's snot every day, you're gonna miss all the sunshine. Naturally, you're gonna be miserable, quit trying, give the sickness space to rent. Flower don't get sunshine, it ain't gonna grow. People don't get enough sunshine, they ain't gonna see any reason to try and bloom either. Reminds me of a fella I knew named Black Eye Titus. Chip, you probably never heard of old Black Eye. I knew him well. Heard of him long before I met him. That's 'cause Black Eye was famous. Famous the same way old Josh Gibson and Buck O'Neill were famous baseball players. White folks ignored them 'cause they were black, but Josh and Buck knew they were among the greatest who ever played the game. Same with Black Eye. He was the greatest entertainer I ever saw. And that includes a lady I once knew in Paris. She could whistle Dixie without using her mouth, if you get my drift. But that's besides the point. A great dancer and singer, Black Eye came along at a time, way back in the 1910s and 20s, when not much notice was given to black performers like him. People too busy paying attention to Al Jolson, who was okay if you liked schizophrenics. I never much understood that blackface shit. Of course, Black Eye noticed what was going on with Jolson, and got the notion of rubbing white shit over his face. Only thing you'd be able to see were his black eyes, the reason for his name. Black folks loved his ass, though. Paid him just for walking down 125th Street, and that was after his show. Those white folks who saw him left dazzled. He had a chance to go as big as Jolson. Maybe bigger. That's what scared folks. One night, when he was asleep in his car, had to sleep in his car 'cause no hotel'd give him a room, some motherfucking Klansman snuck up and cut off his legs. Laughed that he was no man no more. He was half a man. Exactly how they considered black people in general. I was supposed to see Black Eye perform that next night. Had a pretty little girl. The curtain went up and a kid named Calloway came on. Nothing was ever said about Black Eye, and no one heard of him again. About 40-something years later, I was passing through Peoria, Illinois, and wandered into Collins Corner, a little black and tan joint in town. Well, I was supposed to see a young performer. There happened to be an old man at the piano, playing and singing and smiling at some of the ladies, the fat ones. And I didn't think nothing much of it, except that I liked the way he sang. Then I got up to meet a pretty thing. That's when I noticed the old man was in a wheelchair. Upon closer inspection, I saw he didn't have no legs. Well, put one and one together, and sure enough it was two. Black Eye Titus was still alive and kicking, so to speak. Was down and out for a spell, he explained. You was the greatest, I said. What happened? It's this way, he said. I never much noticed my legs was gone as much as I did my spirit. If I couldn't dance, because that's what I did best, and I figured I couldn't do nothing. Besides, when I didn't have on my face, nobody knew I was black-eyed, including me.
You mean without the cream?
Yep. Without the cream, there was no coffee. I probably would have kept talking if Briss Collins, the club's owner, hadn't told us to shut up or get out. As happened, he introduced a young singer-comedian named Richard Pryor, which was the whole reason I was there anyway, passing through town just to give him some advice. I wished I would have told him about Black Eye, because before we quit talking, old Black Eye told me how he spent years trying to drink himself to death. One night he figured he was on his way to doing just that. When he opened his eyes in the morning, it was because he felt something warm on his face. It felt mighty good. Turned out it was just the sun, he chuckled. And that was enough, I asked. Well, the thought dawned on me that it could be. A little pussy, a little warmth, same thing. It's like God's up there playing craps, and all of us peoples is just one roll of the dice. You ain't gonna be a seven every day, but you can hope. And most times, that's enough for me.
30. As a reward for JoJo, I decided to sprint across the country in my Ferrari. People asked why. Simply because I had a Testarossa, you know. That was reason enough. Going 130 miles an hour, I wanted to blaze my own path into the future. Slip in and out of time as it applied to people. Flee the past. Escape Hollywood, a town I didn't like in the first place. But where were you going, Rich? I didn't know. I was just going. Going fast, too. But where? Maybe nowhere. Maybe just away. Or maybe I was trapped. Trapped in a cosmic joke, you know? If so, I wasn't alone. Geraldine Mason, a pretty actress who'd auditioned for JoJo, sat beside me. She had stars for eyes. A smile as bright as a sign in front of the hotel in Las Vegas, where we partied for a few days. And, as far as I knew, she really wanted to be with me. We sped through Las Vegas, intent on getting to Peoria in record time. Somewhere along the way, Geraldine mentioned she might be pregnant. I didn't know there was such a condition as might be pregnant.
Maybe we'll get lucky, she said softly. Maybe nothing will happen.
In my entire life, nothing was something that never happened to me. And that didn't change in 1986. That summer, the first signs of a serious problem surfaced. It snuck up on me while I finished shooting Critical Condition in L.A. I remember being tired by that time, feeling drained of my normal energy. Then one day, the floor caved in. I had been resting in a chair between setups and camera changes when director Michael Apted finally asked me to take my place. I heard him loud and clear. No problem. Okay, Michael, I said. The message was relayed to my brain. My brain said, you have to get the fuck up, Rich. But nothing moved. Raise your ass up off the chair. My brain continued. I tried, but nothing moved. Come on, Richard, the director said. Quit fooling around. I wasn't fooling around. That's what scared me. I'm not joking, I called. I'm trying to get there. And I was. Real hard. But my body wasn't buying that shit. It was fucking with me, like, ha ha ha. You know? I saw my legs, told them to get up and go, but the job order got lost around my waist. My legs were on vacation, numb and dumb. I didn't panic, probably because I didn't know what the fuck was going on. I had to believe it was just a strange muscle twitch, something that was going to pass. After massaging my legs, I shuffled my feet in place, a tentative startup, and then just as strangely as the motherfuckers had quit, they started back up again. My brain was going nuts. You're under your own power. Good, Rich. But what the fuck is going on? Don't matter, just don't fall. I walked funny, but at least I made it to where I was supposed to be and did my scene without incident. Afterward, I didn't know what to make of the problem. I hoped I could forget about it. Tried to, anyway. But it sure tripped up my sanity, you know? After I guessed it on The Tonight Show, a short time later, people noticed a dramatic change in my appearance. I'd suffered a noticeable loss of weight. My body was spindly, and my face looked thin and tired. Suddenly, the rumor mill overflowed with speculation that I had AIDS. I didn't know what the fuck was wrong with me, but blood tests proved it wasn't AIDS. I tried ignoring the symptoms, but that became impossible. At a charity basketball game, I fell down while dribbling the ball. Nobody was around me. My legs just took a time out. I went splat. I looked like a motherfucking clown, though it obviously wasn't funny. After resting, I finished the game. But the incident shook me up. Frightened by the way my eyesight and balance came and went without informing me of its schedule, I finally saw my longtime physician. After he asked a ton of questions and performed numerous tests, I asked him what he thought might be the problem. He looked at me as if I'd just walked through the door. "I'm not sure," he said. "Well, I knew that much. Motherfucker did everything but make lemonade from my piss and didn't know more than I did. That infuriated me, you know, because something was wrong." "I don't believe you," I said. My intuition told me that he suspected the problem but didn't want to tell me. Conservative doctor shit. "We need more information," he counseled. "I really think you should go to the Mayo Clinic for more tests." It took until August for him to finally persuade me it was in my best interests to stop ignoring the problem and go for an examination. Childlike in my fear of what they might discover, I asked Debbie to accompany me. Though we hadn't spoken for a while, she agreed. In spite of all the reasons we couldn't live together, we still loved each other. For the next week, I went through a series of intensive, often frightening and exhausting tests. Embarrassed when my eyes' inability to focus prevented me from describing pictures on large cards, I shifted into unrestrained terror when I saw the needle they were going to use during my spinal tap. At least the pretty nurse was nice. "Now, Mr. Pryor, don't move," she said. "I won't," I replied. "I'm looking at your titties." The brief glimpse might have been the lone bright spot. Unable to handle the fear of what the doctors were going to find, I secretly turned to the only relief I'd ever known. One night, Debbie, worried by the unusually long time I stayed in the bathroom, opened the door and caught me fumbling with a tourniquet and syringe as I shot up with Demerol. "Oh, mama." I stared at her, helpless and frightened and silent. "Mama." She didn't say a word. She took in the scene and backed out of the room, shutting the door. In the movies, I would have heard crying coming from the other side. But there was nothing. Just the sound of my heart beating, and the silent cry in my head for my mother to make it all better. At the end of the week, Debbie and I finally met with the doc. For 5 days, I've been asking what they thought and getting mystified shrugs in return. Now they had a diagnosis. In a plain, emotionless voice, the doctor told me that I had multiple sclerosis. Debbie and I turned and exchanged blank, worried looks. Multiple sclerosis. Those two words hit me like a ball on a backboard. Bounce. "Oh, I got it?" I said. What is it?
The doctor's face was all funny as shit. I never heard a doctor just say,
So, what is it, Doc?
That means you don't know anything about this shit, right?
He told me that the MS was still in its infancy, that I was fortunate.
Your prognosis is good, he said. Many people with MS can live for a long, long time, but...
I told the doctor, you don't know how the fuck I got it, and you don't know when it's going away, so don't be bringing up theories about my cocaine. You didn't even know I did no cocaine.
He still said, maybe it was those 2 ounces you did that time.
I said, man, what do you mean that time? I did 2 ounces every time.
Well, slow down.
I flew back to L.A. in shock. Neither Debbie nor I mentioned a word about MS the entire flight. I didn't know what to think. Living life so large, bigger than life, you tend to believe you have some sort of superhuman power. I'd left the ghetto behind. The whorehouses of my youth were like postcards from past journeys. I'd walked through fire, seen my own motherfucking flesh regenerate. I wanted to see myself as a blessed motherfucker. But suddenly I felt the floor start wobbling. Like an earthquake, my footing was unsure. All my different incarnations stared at me. Child, comedian, asshole, addict, man, father, husband, actor, victim, superstar, patient, child. They all wanted to know the same thing. What now, motherfucker? It occurred to me then that at the outset of life, God gives you a certain number of angels. They hover above you, protecting your ass from danger. But if you cross a certain line too many times, they get the hell away. Say, hey, motherfucker, you've abused us too many times. From here on, you're on your own. That's what scared me, the prospect of being alone. One option was to marry Flynn. Despite all my philandering, she remained as determined as ever to become the next Mrs. Richard Pryor. She'd become a devout Jehovah's Witness, once even trying to convert me while sitting on the edge of my bed. But I didn't hold that against her any more than I did other shit. Worn out and in deep denial, I caved in to fears of being alone, and on October 10, 1986, we married in a civil ceremony performed in a judge's chambers. She brought a girlfriend to witness the occasion. I didn't bring nothing but misgivings. In the weeks following the wedding, I started working out new material at the Comedy Store. Some people talked to psychiatrists, but my biggest insights had always come on stage, so for me it was therapeutic. About the age rumors, I said, that was funny the first time I cleared out an elevator. Flynn's and my 22-year age difference also proved fruitful. My wife is young, I said. The school bus had her back on time today. But it just wasn't the same as before. My performance lacked the passion that had always given my performances an incendiary edge. After leaving the Mayo Clinic, the only constant was the level of chaos in my life. It reached the danger zone when Geraldine gave birth to my son Franklin. The news pissed off Flynn, who wanted to be the mother of the youngest prior offspring. What could I do, you know? Try to get away. If only I'd been able. Separated in early December, after less than 2 months of marriage, our divorce was finalized in January. As we left for court, Flynn sashayed out of the house, wearing a fur coat, with nothing on underneath. The upshot? Roughly 10 months later, Kelsey was born. She was my 6th child. Her mother was my 5th ex-wife. I wondered if I was ever going to roll a 7. Probably not. Better not. Later on, I got a vasectomy to make sure I damn well didn't. But God love us all anyway. You know? 31.